Hey everyone, it's Chelsea. I'm preempting myself because there's a little update to the episode you're about to listen to slash watch. So I recorded this episode with my dear friend Ryan so that we could talk about love and money, but also promote our upcoming Philadelphia event for our Love and Money tour. It was initially scheduled for next Monday, October 30th, but quite frankly, given everything going on in the world and how it's affecting the people on our team and some of the people who were meant to join the event with us, we made the decision to delay the event and are going to be hosting it a little bit later in the year when everyone is hopefully a little bit more in the mood to do something fun and frivolous and also informative because, our events always are. For all of the people that had tickets to our Philly event, you will be contacted and hopefully you can join us at the later date. And if not, we will be announcing the details very soon so that you can grab your spot for when we regroup a bit later in the year. We'll also be visiting some other cities in the US and Canada, so do always keep your eyes peeled for the fun events we're going to be doing. Live podcast recordings of this very show, of course, but also just hanging out and having a fabulous evening talking about money. Now, here's the episode Ryan and I recorded in all of its glory.
Hello, welcome back to an all new episode of The Financial Confessions with your girl Chelsea Fagan. Now, I'm in a giggly mood today because we have what is the Jordan Peterson to my Joe Rogan. A guest, is that? I guess it's probably amongst his most frequent guests.
Yeah.
Okay, either way, we have a guest who's been on TFC more than any other guest, who also is the host of our flagship podcast, Too Good to Be True, coming back in 2024. We're about to cover some more scandals and crimes and scams. Also, just a very good friend, IRL, the one, the only, the incomparable, Ryan Houlihan.
Hello, everybody. I'm so glad to be back.
I'm so glad to have you.
And thanks to Kelley Blue Book Service Advisor for supporting TFC. Kelley Blue Book Service Advisor provides confidence that you're getting the right price for your repairs, and it connects you with local service providers. Plus, it has information on common car problems and current recalls. Learn more at kbb.com or click the link in the episode description.
And thanks to Delete Me for supporting TFC. Remove your personal info from data broker websites. And we have a special discount for you. Get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/TFC and use promo code TFC. Anyway, so it's spooky season. It's the leaves are turning. It's When Harry Met Sally season. And we have later this month our very first long form video because, as you know, we're pivoting to a once monthly long form video. And it's all about the rom-com and how it kneecapped millennial women from a financial perspective. But it's also notably cuffing season. People are coupling up. They're settling down.
Yeah, it's time to have somebody to take to holiday parties and
It's time to have someone to cuddle with when
Yeah.
watching a movie or watching it snow or watching the leaves turn. So we are going to talk about money and relationships today, and specifically some of the new rules that we may need to implement when it comes to dating. Now, for those who may not know, our friend Ryan is a member of the LGBTQIA plus, is that it?
Yeah,
Community?
a couple of those.
Yeah, like Che Diaz. In fact,
Oh,
some might say inspired by Che Diaz.
Sometimes when I'm watching that show, I just think like this is the worst representation. This set us back a decade. Sorry, Sarah Ramirez, you're doing a great job with what you have.
With what Sarah has to work with. But Ryan is a non-binary friend who, is it fair to say, primarily dates men?
Yeah.
Okay, so point being, we are diverging quite substantially from the heteronormative script when it comes to dating, which has, for as many changes as we've made in society, largely remained somewhat stagnant, at least in the courting phase. So one of the first things I want to talk about with you is like, what are some of the financial rules and norms around dating when you don't have that overarching dynamic of man pays?
So I think I've been on a bunch of dates with people where I knew that I had financial means that they perhaps didn't just by virtue of knowing their lifestyle. And so I would pick up the check for certain stuff. I think what it really comes down to is like, what's the vibe? But also, are you doing multiple things? If one person pays for dinner, the other person should pay for drinks. Or you can just split evenly. I know a lot of men who just split e everything evenly. And I think those are all totally valid options. But I think the fun thing about being queer, one of the fun things, is that once you've rethought monogamy and you've already like disappointed your parents and reoriented what a relationship is going to be based on the script you're given as a child, it opens up a lot of options for you. And so I think you can have that discussion a little more freely, because it isn't, I think when cishet couples have that discussion, if like, oh, should we split the bill? It feels like the man is somehow dodging their responsibility or something, even though I don't think that that's true.
Being a broke boy, some might say.
Yeah. And I think in the queer community, it's a little more loosey-goosey.
Yeah, I think, although I have heard tell that sometimes the norms around that do still fall under a sort of general vibe of like masculinity and femininity, mm-hmm. like a more masculine partner might be more, I guess, in the best iteration, chivalrous, in the worst kind of, patriarchal when it comes to paying.
I think that that's true across the board in some of these relationships. I think like it's easy to fall into a script you already have. And I think a lot of the time I've had men go out of their way to like treat me as they assume that I would want to be treated by a man. But I think it's also a great excuse for men to get out of some stuff that they don't want to do. Like, chivalry is fun and all when you're like sweeping someone into your arms. But on the day to day, like, can I help you carry things? Men are not going to do other men favors. Or, you know, AMAB people, they're not going to bend over backwards. But, you know, again, queer relationships are kind of a new thing, and I think to be discussing publicly. And I think like with that comes a level of self-exploration. Like, I used to present much more masculine, and I've been with my husband for a really long time, and we used to have kind of a different dynamic. And I don't know if it's subconscious or what it is, but as I have, I mean, I came out in my mid-20s as non-binary, and as I've embraced more femininity and stuff, he has slipped more into like that breadwinner man role. And I don't know how comfortable I am with it, but I don't know. I think we're also like of a different generation. Maybe younger people don't feel that way.
We're going to get to like a point where everyone is just like an ether moving around. Like, no one is bound by any constraints.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I'm a cartoon character, first and foremost.
So, I mean, that's interesting, the non-binary versus gay male thing. I think part of the interesting thing to look at, too, is not just like who pays on a first date, right? Because I do think that is starting to vary a bit more. Like, have you seen the viral TikTok thing of like the woman who went on a date and had 48 oysters? Okay. Oh, my God. I'm so excited I get to tell someone this story. So our story begins in Atlanta, Georgia. A woman goes out on a date with this man for the first, it's a first date. And I actually don't know the lore as to like who suggests, I think she suggested this location, but I think the pretext was we're going for drinks, but this place is like a seafood place known for its oysters. And I guess our heroine really likes an oyster. So she goes away. So she goes to this restaurant. She's basically the entire time, and she cuts in and out. So I don't know if the camera was on the entire time, but for a huge portion of this date, she's filming the oysters with the like the flashlight on, like, and all you hear is just slurping. And then you also see while she consumes 48 oysters, never clear if the man has an oyster, while she consumes 48 oysters, she's also consuming, I think she has a total of 3 lemon drops, martinis, during this date. And then after finishing the oysters, orders crab cakes and potatoes. So between, I think, the oysters and the crab cakes, she goes to the bathroom to freshen up and comes back, and she is left with the bill. The man has left, which to that I say king, exhibiting king behavior.
Yeah, I was going to say sprinkle, sprinkle to her, but honestly, I don't think he's in the wrong. You did not give any notice.
No, but also, I mean, first of all, eating 48 of anything is a crazy quantity.
Aren't they an aphrodisiac too? Are you like climbing the walls?
I'm worried about her mercury levels.
Guy leaves heavy metals.
Also, just a side note is that at the end of this date, it's a $200 bill or a $180 bill. She leaves $11 as a tip. So the story just keeps
brought up on charges. This is like.
But point being, so this has like gone viral on TikTok. Like, I've seen so many people commenting on it, but it has also kind of launched this discussion about, because so basically there's like two in like extreme heteronormative world, there are two sort of warring factions. One is you should, like, regardless of gender, everything should be 50-50. It's better to start out on like a low stakes coffee date, because then you don't necessarily have to stay for a very long time, but also no one's like spending an exorbitant amount of money to see the other person. We can, you know, be flexible with all different income levels, blah, blah, blah. And then there's the other one, which is often couched in like the divine feminine, the like, you know, high energy, all of like the high frequency energy, whatever, where it's like any man that's like not willing to take you to Nobu on a first date and spend $300 is not a man that's worth your time. And it's like there's all these tutorials about like how to pivot away from a coffee drinks or just date or a coffee or just drinks moment, how to like pivot toward more expensive things, how to, and so there's really sort of two schools of thought, and I sort of understand where both are coming from to an extent. Take from outside of the asylum.
I was going to say, this is why I can't watch straight dating shows, because there's a lot going on that to even discuss disqualifies you all of a sudden. Like, to even address it means like you're some kind of problem. I think it's different too for queer people, at least for queer men, or like anyone who engages with queer men sexually, that there's a lot less first dates and more like first hookups and then deciding if this person is worth seeing again. And I think sometimes what I have experienced is people want to establish early on that they're just not looking for a hookup. So what they'll do is they'll be like, I'm going to take you on a real date. Like, we're going to go to dinner. We're going to get drinks afterward. And like, that's to establish that, I guess, that I'm interested in you romantically. But the problem there is that like you're stuck. Like, you're going to be there for a while. So I think, like, leaving it open-ended is actually maybe something we could learn from, like, your community. It's like, maybe we should just be going for coffee. Maybe we should just be, like, lightly checking each other out. You know what I mean? It feels safer, too. But the thing is, with the hookup thing, is one of you gets to see the other one's apartment generally. And that helps contextualize a relationship a lot really quickly. Sometimes I feel like anytime I'm dating somebody, like, I need to see a picture of their apartment next to the selfie on Bumble. Do you know what I mean? I want to know if you live like this.
I, like, cannot. I'll never not think of the picture of Hillary Clinton walking through that Brooklyn apartment.
I've done that before.
With, like, the plant in the sink where she's like, what is this, honey?
Why a refrigerator? I mean, sorry. Hold on. Can we talk about boy apartments in general?
Let's talk about them, because trust me, they exist in straight world too.
What is going on? I mean, just have someone you're dating for a couple weeks pick out your furniture if you can't handle it. Like, trick me.
Okay, I need to tell you, and by extension all of you at home, a little bit about my husband's apartment when we first started dating. So my husband, for those who may not know, is now amongst, I would say, in the 99th percentile of fastidious and well-groomed and organized and clean straight men I've ever met.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Total cosine.
And when I met him, this was obviously out and about. It was on a first date. And he was dressed in a suit with a very nice wool coat on, because he was a consultant, where you have to dress like that. And you travel usually most days of the week. So you are like, a lot of your life is lived outside the home and in hotels, but also you are like, you have to present to the outside world at a certain level. Now I would say the outer and the inner are matched up perfectly. At the time, when I tell you the jump scare, so I go back to my now husband's house for the first time. So first and foremost, he lives with a roommate, still to this day his best friend. He was the one that he was living with for the first several years of us dating. So yeah, I think unfortunately he's seen me in my birthday suit more times than either of us would probably like to admit by accident. But so you walk into the apartment, the living room is my husband's room, on the floor, carpet, wall-to-wall carpet, which is tough to find. Ooh. In a Parisian apartment that was probably constructed in the 1600s. So, I mean, they have a bed bug problem now. I can only imagine what that carpet has seen over the years. So you walk in, there's that mattress on the floor, of course. Sheets, dark colored sheets, dark blue sheets, of course they are. Why? Because the sheets have never been washed, not once in their lives.
Nope.
Pillow, a nice shade of goldenrod because it had never been washed.
Just an ecosystem of dust mites living in a little metropolis.
Dust over every surface. Now you walk into the hallway. To the right is just an IKEA shelf full of food. To the left is just two hot plates, a little sink that's the size of like a dinner plate, and then a microwave. You might be asking, where's the refrigerator? Well, the refrigerator is in the bathroom of the apartment. There is a full-size bathroom. With a shower, sink, toilet, as any bathroom would be, and then a full-size white refrigerator in the middle of the bathroom. And so if you needed to get ingredients for your lunch, you needed to get a nice refreshing soda in the afternoon, you have to go into the bathroom. And like most
Nobody lit it up before you needed to get something appetizing.
Often was the case, but like with any apartment occupied by two 20-something bachelor men, it is as if every single morning, because they both had to shave every day for work, because they both were like in very professional workplaces. It's as if every morning they like went into the bathroom and just went with, with a handful of hair. That?
I have been removing hair my entire life. I have never once left it in a pile for someone to clean up. Very strange behavior. I will say stuff like that is what gets me, because I don't need someone to have a bunch of money or to show me like an amazing apartment. Is it nice? Yeah. But, you know, that's the society we live in. But what I need you to do is the stuff that's free. Fold up a blanket before someone enters your
Wash
home.
Wash a sheet, honey.
Before I sleep on it. Yes.
I swear to God, like those pillows, because like they were obviously, there was one, first of all. Pillows. I've already misled us. Pillow is what we're talking about.
Only in your 20s with truly the spine of like an elastic band.
And I will say, to his credit, quite a gentleman. He always allowed me the pillow, but it was so decrepit and so lifeless by that point that I had to like roll it up like a sleeping bag in order to get some lift on my head. And as I mentioned, you take off that pillowcase, just
radioactive. Just
yellow to the bone.
Isotopes. I was dating a guy, and this is when I knew I really wanted to date him for a while. We were hooking up, and I was having a good time, but you know, you get a little warm, a little flush towards the end, and I sweat into his pillow, and I was like, oh my God, I'm sorry, I think I lived a little sweat scene. He popped that thing right in the wash while I was there. He was like, oh, let me just clean it before I go to bed. King. Absolutely. Even if you're faking it, you know, the knowledge to do that.
It's you really had some tough ones. I have to share one other anecdote, not my husband, but another man that I did know biblically who lived in a basement apartment. This was the second home he was in while we were dating. The first one, if you can imagine, was much worse than this anecdote for other reasons. But the room in this one was, it was one of those basements that probably wasn't even legal to have as a room because there were no windows. So like a terrarium, full wall-to-wall carpet with like a thick shag. And then all of the walls were like that fake wood paneling. So just basement rec room. At least the 70s.
Need but some so, cheese balls and deviled eggs.
Never once, I think, had that room been cleaned or, I mean, seen a UV ray or like anything that might sanitize it. So one night, and of course, mattress right on the floor, as it should be in the corner of
what
this.
What do men have against box springs or a bed frame? Like, in a room, give me a headboard.
No less with. That is, I mean, a full 85%+ humidity at all times. So anyway, I'm laying there one night. He's on a snack run late at night to the 7-Eleven, and I feel something move across my face. Shout out for restraining yourself from the scream I know you wanted to elicit. But so I'm freaking out, can't find it for the life of me. He comes home from getting snacks and he's got his little flashlight going because there's not too much lighting in the room. And he's like, oh, found your culprit, a centipede about yay big on the wall next to the bed where I was laying my little head.
I was going to say, did something escape the terrarium? But no, it was just another part of the menagerie.
I'm in the terrarium. It's me and the tarantulas and the centipedes. And you might be saying to yourself, well, at least that was rock bottom and you left him. No, no. We dated for another 6 months until he cheated on me.
Bleak. That is so bleak. Did he cheat on you with somebody who's like knew how to clean his apartment? Because then I would let it go if she straightened up before she left. I will say, I think also when men live together, it becomes like a masculine off about not being the one who's going to do the cooking and cleaning. And like, play stupid games, win stupid prizes. If you were the one who did all the cleaning and then told me that, I would be so impressed. It's actually not impressive to me that you have lived in like filth or whatever.
I think there's also, this is something that I do not think gets addressed enough in dating world. And hey, my in-laws don't speak English, so I can say this. When I first started like going to my now husband's parents' place, like I noticed how much of the cleaning for the three grown adult male children gets done by the mom. Yeah. And I think that that is, and now obviously I've since, you know, my husband knows better and he's very much like he cleans for himself and takes care of himself, you know, in terms of domestic tasks. But I really do think a lot of men, regardless of sexuality, because of the way that they're socialized, often by their mothers, like arrive into adulthood and then by extension, long-term relationships, never having learned how to do a lot of domestic tasks or even without the implicit knowledge that it was their responsibility.
I think a lot of men also just don't know what needs to be done. I was having a conversation with my husband a couple months ago, and I said to him, do you think like dust just doesn't come into this apartment? Or do you think maybe I'm doing all the dusting? And I think like that just doesn't, also like stuff like I don't know, you see a lot of stuff like a dirty vent and you're like, it's the attention to detail that like feels foisted on other people that men do not feel foisted upon themselves. And I mean, you know, God bless, I wish I felt that level of complete comfortability with myself at all times. But I think it's part and parcel with like the grooming thing. Like, I don't think men talk about different ways to like solve grooming problems. Like when you go through a men's magazine, sometimes there's stuff. It's like, here's like your, you know, waxing kit or something for a sensitive area. But in general, it's not like I'm having this problem, this kind of odor, how do I solve it? Whereas you go through women's magazines and there is a lot of that information present. And I think it just kind of set a precedent. But I think also being trans and like knowing trans people, seeing both sides of it, you can kind of see the level of, I don't know, silliness on both sides. But it also gives you some insight into like the kind of pressures put on you. Like, I think when a man makes a TikTok in his dirty apartment, nobody cares. When a woman or like a queer person of another gender is in their apartment, like it gets commented on.
I think that's very true. And I think there's also a huge amount of self-worth that's tied up with your surroundings
and
presentation.
Yeah.
Presentation generally, I think, is like a big cost that is imposed on non-men. And I would say even more non-straight men, because I think even amongst queer men, there is a huge pressure.
Everything's got to be made of leather and chrome.
Well, and also, I mean, not for nothing, but the body expectations like that. I mean, one thing I will say about being a woman who dates men is that although there can often be a crippling pressure to be thin, and I don't want to deny that whatsoever, that is a huge problem. Like, it seems like a level above and beyond that you not only, for men who date men, often have to be low body fat percentage, but also buff. Buff as hell, which is like a hard body type for anyone to achieve.
I mean, I do sometimes think about this, this sheer amount of schedule and money that goes into like creating the body that you see on gay men at certain events and stuff. And it's overwhelming. I mean, it's very much tied in with the AIDS crisis, like this idea that if you look healthy, that that's the only aspiration.
Totally.
And the fact that like we didn't have a generation of mature men to really look up to, we being, you know, me until my mid-20s. But I also think like it's a lot of time and money, and I can see how just stuff shifts. I mean, I think about all the time, like I'm supposed to be meditating. I'm supposed to be meal prepping. I'm supposed to be I'm supposed to be going on walks to exercise at minimum. I'm supposed to be keeping up on current events. I'm supposed to be watching current pop culture. I'm supposed to listen to some music every day. I'm supposed to get work done. Like, it's too much. And I think you're forced to make some choices and trade-offs. And I have found, you know, during my transition, I've found that I'm able to pull up on certain things that just don't matter anymore. But also when people recontextualize you, the pressure is off. And so, like, yeah, I think maybe the pressure of your surroundings might be a little different, and you can put more time and energy into it. But I think there's a bare minimum floor we all need to be reaching in every category to, like, I don't know, for me to feel, like, comfortable jumping in and dating somebody is to know that, like, you're able to balance a bunch of that stuff. And I think that's also true of just budgeting, like, your life, you know? Like, if sometimes I know people with incredibly expensive clothes all the time, and the apartment is, like, bare bones, like the budget has not been invested in that end of things. And I'm like, maybe we trade one coat and we have a couch. But I think our generation is unfortunately, in that financial problem area so much more, like, it's so much more common. And frankly, we're not having kids. There is also an expectation that you can create a home for kids. And when you're maybe take that off the table, or like you're delaying that a lot, you have this extended
adolescence. For non-straight people, you mean?
I mean, I think for anybody, but I would connect it by saying, like, especially gay men, but for any queer couple that isn't having kids, you're creating a different environment, and like you can curate a very different life. Like at my age, my parents owned their house outright and it was like spotless. They had two brand new cars, and like part of that is money. 100% an opportunity that another generation had. But another part of it is just like that was their priority because they had three kids.
Right.
I don't have kids. And so like I can spend a little more time on other stuff. And my apartment doesn't have to be like childproofed. It can just look like however I want it to look, which is aspirational. But like I never had you over until I was able to do that. And I wasn't really able to do that till both me and my husband lived together for a long time and we moved up in our careers. But then when I could have people over, it opened up a ton of different areas of my life. Like kinds of socializing, content I could make, like it's silly things, but even just like having a refuge that feels personal, and it transforms other stuff going forward. Like you said, a lot of men spend a lot of time out of their apartments. Part of that is good, right? But then another part of it is like, well, what do you do when you're alone? Because we're going to be alone together a lot.
I think a lot of men never ask themselves that question, or if they do, like it's, I mean, I think they're not all, but a lot of men, we've talked a lot before on the channel about the epidemic of loneliness among straight older men. I think that like lack of curating not just friendships and platonic relationships, but a level of interiority. Like I saw a discourse recently on TikTok about how like, you know, I think the initial video that sparked the conversation was like women will have like, you know, tragic fallouts with friends and like never speak to them again. And that never happens to men. And on one level, that's true in my experience. But on another deeper level, it's because men, if they even have friends, which is not always the case, they don't reach that level of interiority with each other. And so they have what amounts to, I think someone said, lifelong acquaintances. And women have meaningful, profound relationships with real emotional stakes, which leads them to, you know, eventually in some cases, not many maybe, but in some to have fallouts. But I think that the general sentiment amongst a lot of men is just when it comes to scheduling activities, having hobbies, having a social life, doing things on weekends, that almost always in hetero partnerships falls to the woman to curate and present to them. And they're just sort of following along.
I did want to talk about this and we can come back around. But like, I think also with a lot of trans people or non-binary people, there's a level of gender dysphoria and euphoria to the ways you're socializing or the ways that you're like conducting your lifestyle. And, you know, some people experience that, some people don't. I'm non-binary. I take whatever I want from wherever in gender. I think it's all very silly. I think you're all being ridiculous about colors. I think, like, I'm just going to pick the colors I like. None of my business. But I think a lot of trans people feel a certain level of, like, validation and, like, you know, affirmation to be treated in a specific way, like, say, pay the bill or not pay the bill. But to connect that, I would say the trans men that I know are holding their male friend groups together personally with like Elmer's glue. They're the one planning activities. They're the one facilitating like, so Brian, you went through a breakup. How are we feeling about that? I mean, they're the ones checking holding it together, white knuckling, because female friendships, or at least being pushed into female spaces, even if you're not. And as a person who grew up like the gay BFF all through high school, you really are forced to like talk things out and to like, I don't know, really embrace each other and give each other feedback. You know, a lot of the women in my life will give me feedback on my apartment, and that's great. I want to know thoughts. I don't think men do that.
So I'm currently a non-driving queen, but I did used to be a driver, and my husband and I pretty regularly rent cars when we travel. So I am very familiar with Kelly Blue Book, especially in terms of how essential it was to make sure I was getting the best return on my investment when I was a previous car owner, and at the time was, let's just say, fairly budget conscious. And you're likely familiar with Kelly Blue Book as the place that you go when you want transparent, objective information when you're in the market for a car or looking to get maintenance work done on your car. But you may not know about Service Advisor. Service Advisor is designed to give car owners confidence that they're getting the right price for repairs and connects them with local service providers. Plus, it has information on common car problems and current recalls. Getting and maintaining a car is a true investment, and Kelly Blue Book helps you make the best financial decisions so that you can get the most out of that investment. With access to customer reviews, service promotions, service center websites, and available service scheduling with price estimations, Kelly Blue Book Service Advisor helps car owners confidently identify top local auto repair shops and find the fairest price for services. With more than 95 years of experience, Kelly Blue Book is the trusted resource when it comes to car research, including new and used car pricing, repair and maintenance information, and advice for buying or selling your car, allowing consumers to navigate buying, selling, and owning a vehicle with confidence. Service Advisor provides insight on common problems car owners face using data from services that others with similar vehicles have had performed. And it also has a Q&A forum where owners can ask service-related questions so that you're never alone. They also answer key car ownership questions and provide personalized information, like what services to have done, when to have them performed locally, if your car has a recall, and most importantly, how much all of this should cost based on similar repairs in the area. The two foundational pillars of Kelly Blue Book involve instilling trust and confidence in car shoppers and owners. Learn more about Kelly Blue Book Service Advisor at kbb.com or click the link in the episode description.
If you're living in 2023 and you're on the internet, your data, very personal data, is probably available to everyone who's ready to pay for it. And it's kind of scary. As someone who has personally been on the internet for over 10 years at this point, like, I was pretty shocked to find out when I did my first Delete Me report, like, just how much of my personal information was available out there. Like, they did their first report and I had my data removed from literally 61 different data broker websites in just the first report. And that's information like my full name, my home address, my phone number, which is honestly terrifying. Because there are companies out there called data brokers whose entire job is to collect huge amounts of your personal info, like your name, address, phone number, social security number, and even information about your relatives, which is all then sold online. Kind of insane. But the good news is that this is where Delete Me comes in to help you. Delete Me protects your data from data brokers, reducing the risk of identity theft, scams, and those annoying spam emails and calls that we all get. Their software and team of experts will not just find and remove your personal information from hundreds of data broker websites, but they'll continuously scan for new data that shows up and get that removed as well. Instead of you spending hours of your time figuring out how to remove this data, Delete Me does it for you. Before you get into a panic, take control of your data by signing up for Delete Me. It's super easy to use and it simply works. And they offer a special discount for our listeners. Get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/TFC and use promo code TFC. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/TFC and enter promo code TFC at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/TFC, promo code TFC. When I look at my gay, male, or Abe Mab friends, there are really two categories. One is the men who have a lot of women friends. And then a few of the gay male friends that I have told me on multiple occasions that I'm basically the only woman they socialize with. And the radical difference that I see in so many aspects of their lives is really, really fascinating to me. And I would say in some ways, they scan to me as closer to straight. Like, it's almost like they're hetero men that date men, if that makes sense, mm-hmm. just in terms of their socialization, yeah. in terms of a lot of their activities, in terms of the way they relate to other people and the nature of a lot of their relationships and the things that they want to talk about and all of that kind of stuff. And I do think as we enter a world that is more fluid and less categorized on so many of these fronts, the real question to me is going to be like, do you have these vestiges of a socialization that puts people into a romantic or a romantic slash sexual or don't care category, which yeah. is the truth of a lot of men? Or are you someone who builds communities that are hugely diverse in terms of the way relationships can manifest and what purpose they serve, which I think is more generally true of women?
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I also think like a lot of the times I see women go out and hunt out women they want to be friends with. They'll be like, how do I get her to go to a movie with me? And I'm like,
we annex each other.
Yeah. And I kind of think that humbles you in a friendship. And if you're humbled in your friendships, you're going to be pretty humble with a relationship because there's a lot more at stake. I think a lot of men, and again, these are just generalities. I could talk about masculinity and femininity and gender for hours, but I think a lot of men fall into relationships. So it's like coworkers and they fall out of those relationships. And it becomes on the person they're dating to have couple friends or to like help maintain all of that. And it is a lot of work. Like if we want to talk about unpaid emotional labor, it's a lot of work. And you get better at it the more you do it. And I think, like, when you make it to, like, your early 30s and you haven't learned any of those skills, it can be really overwhelming and isolating. And I think we're already in a loneliness epidemic, so, like...
Hugely. I mean, to go back to the not having kids thing, like, I do often think as a woman, when I look at, you know, the financial, professional, personal choices that a lot of women around me who do want children and hope to have them biologically have to make, like, they're... Like, in some ways, I do feel like I almost get to live as a man, quote unquote, because I, one of the most defining features, I think, for adult men or people who can't have children for any reason is that they don't have that unspoken shot clock on them at all times that forces certain decisions, that forces certain financial realities, and forces a lot of life choices that go along with it. And I think that is one of the things, because I think most women are lucid about the fact that in hetero partnerships, and we had Eve Rodsky on the channel, for example, who wrote this really amazing book, Fair Play, that's all about the wildly uneven dividing of domestic labor and hetero partnerships between a man and a woman who both work in most cases. Like, there's this now, I think, latent awareness. Like, before, there was a biological pressure for women to have children by a certain age because of just their ability to conceive, their ability to, you know, withstand a pregnancy without major complications, etc. But on top of it now, because most women work, there is this additional pressure that informs every choice of, I know on some level that I am not only going to be responsible for bearing this child, I'm going to be responsible for doing the majority of the child rearing and the majority of everything else, like you said, the emotional labor that goes along with just maintaining basic family life.
I think another part of it is that, like, for queer people, there's this divide where a lot of us, I mean, and you know, there's shades of gray, but a lot of us feel like, I'm never going to have that, like, picture perfect Desperate Housewives house. So I'm free to do whatever. I'll find my fulfillment in other places. I don't feel like this is my identity or future. And then there is a strain of people that I don't know a ton, but for whom I think proving that they can do it becomes their life's work. Being like, I can have a spouse, monogamous, we'll live in the suburbs. I'm going to have 2.5 kids. We're going to do it either biologically or, like, whatever the most, like, conventional version of it is. And I'm going to pull this off. And the tough thing is, you're not just facing against the odds of, like, you know, the economic climate we find ourselves in and the declining population and, like, you know, schools are getting worse and they're pulling books about your family out of them in certain states. Like, all of those odds, you're on top of that, you're queer. So you're going to face those hardships. You have to find someone else in the queer community who has that same goal as you, which is a little rarer. It becomes incredibly difficult. And so, yeah, some of those people, I know a couple who seems like their entire life's work has been attempting to accomplish this. And they also feel like it's their responsibility politically to, like, be an example and prove that. And I think, like, you, as a queer person, you're forced, you're not forced, but you feel forced to make that decision really early. Whereas I think straight people put that off over and over and over again. I know someone who was in a relationship for almost 10 years, and her partner came to her and he was like, I'm ready to have kids. And she was like, what are you talking about? Like, I've said this entire relationship, I don't want kids. And he was like, yeah, but, you know, women change their mind. And she was like, no, what are you talking about? And I don't think that I find that in the queer community a ton. Maybe in lesbian circles, but, you know, chaos queens, love them. Just joking.
I think it's a tough situation, right? Because, you know, it's no longer even necessarily fair to say that, especially as hetero couples have children later and later in life, it is less and less the case that couples are just by chance having children,
yeah,
by accident, you know, against their own will or what have you. I think it's becoming more and more, at least in a lot of social circles and, you know, for a lot of the population. I mean, we see on average these numbers are getting older and older and older, which just on a purely biological level for the time being means that having children must be a more intentional act because it's more difficult to conceive as you get older. So for a lot of people, like a lot of straight people are having to enter increasingly into a realm that used to be a more rare occurrence or the realm of people who couldn't conceive naturally, which is this has to be a project. This has to be something that I very intentionally embark on, that I must be it potentially willing to spend a huge amount of money on.
I mean, it's a bigger commitment than your career, than your marriage, than literally anything. Like, you're totally taking on the responsibility for someone's entire life. It's a big deal.
And even just that, like, for example, like when you're talking about alternative means of conceiving, like the expense that that puts on couples, the amount of debt that that can possibly entail.
My parents put a lot of pressure on me to have kids, and I don't know how, like, I keep saying to them, like, pick a lane for me. It's going to cost $100,000 or it's a full-time job. So I already have a job and I don't have like $100,000 to spend on something that isn't like my retirement eventually. So, you know, it stinks because we're also hearing from, you know, different political sources and social commenters that like people aren't having enough kids and we're going to go into population decline. And I wish there was a way to incentivize people, and especially queer couples. There are so many loving queer homes that would be wonderful environments for children that are ready to go. But again, who has $100,000 to arrange an adoption or, you know, some kind of surrogacy thing if that's what you're into? Or even foster care is basically a full-time job. It's a lot to ask of people, and I think it's such a minor investment to make this possible for a lot of couples, or to relieve the pressure so that you know at some point if you do want that, you don't have to make it your whole life's plan. It's such a small investment for such a return, but we're living how we're living. And I think another part of this is that, like, you know, we're all banding together in some way too, and helping each other accomplish this. I've seen, especially in the queer community, if you decide you want to have kids, other queer people who have kids are like, let's do this. Like, everybody, like, squad assemble, because we are all going to face similar problems and you need people to back you up.
And I think, I mean, it's a tough, like, I do think, well, I would be interested actually to hear your, so obviously dating is one thing, but as you enter into a relationship that becomes more serious, more long-term, whether or not it's monogamous, if you are living with one other person, and again, as we've discussed, there tends to be a pretty, not correct, but inevitable for many couples, hetero couples, a division of labor that becomes more and more imbalanced, more and more skewed toward the woman taking on more responsibility, regardless of what she might bring to the relationship economically, but also a general ambiance of the only labor that matters is the labor that occurs outside the home and earns money. So like, if you're earning more, it's less your responsibility to, I don't know, take care of your own children or what have you. I'm interested in hearing like how that tends to shake out on the longer term amongst couples who don't have those norms imposed.
Well, you know, my husband and I are in an open relationship. We are like, you know, I guess poly is the word, but I don't really use it.
Would you say poly?
Yeah, I mean, I'd throw it out there. The terms are pretty, it's similar to being non-binary. We haven't really, I mean, we have, but most of you at home, statistically, have not really been talking about that for the last 100 years. So we have new words we need to come up with. Someone asked me the other day, what do I call my niece or nephew who's come out as non-binary? And I'm like, their first name. We don't have it. You know, some people have thrown around Nick's, which I like, but like, there's not a ton of, in any event, when you start rethinking your relationships in those ways, it trickles down into things that are silly and trivial, but also into things that are big. And like, my husband does not want me spending money on a date. He doesn't want me spending his money on a date. So like, our finances are fairly divided. I'm not going to use one of our communal cards on something like dinner with someone else. It just feels uncomfortable, even though he's totally fine with me doing that. It just, it creates like these nuances that maybe are silly, but that you start navigating. I think when you start rethinking some of these things, you have to make snap decisions. There isn't a precedent for how you handle this, every little intricacy, every little conversation. And so you make these decisions, but then that's the easiest decision to keep making. And you end up sort of calcifying into, and it becomes more extreme, certain things. I think that's the same for any couple. I think like, if you start being like, I clean the kitchen, it's really easy to be like, I clean after all the meals, which becomes a pretty easy way to be like, I'll just cook. And then like, your domain is the kitchen, which is a huge amount of activity and work.
That's me who somehow ended up with the bathroom, Mark.
Oh, I have the bathroom too. I have the bathroom and the living room. But, you know, he doesn't do it right. So then I got to the bedroom and the kitchen.
Yeah, that man, listen, the state of grime that was in his bathroom when I met him, the just like the hairs, the grime, the mildew, like I know what that man is comfortable living with. Now, it may have changed now, but I know that even by his today standards, his definition of clean and mine for the bathroom is just so different. Mm-hmm. Especially because, like, one thing they do right in Europe that we really need to get on board with is having the toilet in a separate space from the shower and sink.
Yes.
Because it is, like, my mother's a biology teacher, and she once told me what happens when you flush a toilet. I'll never forget it.
My toothbrush is vacuum sealed because I have a little tiny NYC apartment, and I just can't fathom that it would just be sitting out in the open.
Yeah.
Mine's not to put it in all your heads.
But. No. Mine's out in the open sometimes, and I got to correct that. I'm like, now I'm thinking about it. But I do think that there is that, like you said, the calcification of it all really does bother me, because you don't even realize that you're entering these norms as you do. And then, you know, for in my case, I mean, you've been with your husband for quite some time. I've been with my husband for nearly 13 years now. Like, there's definitely a level of... and I've not aged a day somehow, but there is a level of like, when did this happen? And now this is just the way things are. That being said, to get back to the polycule of it all. So now I asked if you would classify yourself as poly, because my understanding of poly was always like, and perhaps this is a limited understanding where like you got a whole squad going, there's just like a bunch of you. And I... frankly, like I can totally wrap my head around the finances of open relationships and swinging, to be perfectly honest, and like all of that.
There's a lot of entry fees to masquerade parties, I assume.
But anytime I see like these TikToks where it's like, and sometimes it's like straight polycules or whatever, like, or, you know, mixed, like there's all different kinds of stuff going on there. And it's like five people.
A lot of stuff going on there.
Like five people in a house in Portland, and they're talking about like, you know, this is how we like divide this and that and the other. And I'm like, someone show me a freaking QuickBooks account for this house, because I need to see where the finances are in all of this, and how are they falling along gender presentation lines and seniority, and like how is this being managed financially?
I'm not keeping multiple people in one house, because I think the lowest common denominator is where that bathroom gets stuck. So let's start there. But second, I think it's different for everybody. I personally want some defined basic ground rules. I want some, like, I don't want to be mixing and matching. Like, if my husband is dating somebody, that's not for me to be involved in, for me personally.
But also, like, are they responsible for the mortgage? I don't know. Like, it's...
Well, yeah. So that, I mean, that makes the rules easier is what I mean. Like, it's, you know, it's a little more complicated. Like, I don't know how you would manage that in a giant house full of people. I mean, I would assume an enormous amount of communication and transparency. But again, that's like, that's going to become someone in that polycule's full-time job to be like, well, what are we doing?
I think of it from a perspective of, in our business, there's four partners who are on that operating agreement, who have to be in a agreement for certain big decisions, who have financial investment, who are like, I mean, we are locked up, baby. Like, it's as if it were a marriage, but we have a substantial, you know, asset together that we are tasked with managing and all of that, which is also the case for a couple that shares most of their life together. In the case of four people who have to come to an agreement on something, you better believe there is a lawyer present for every conversation.
Oh,
we always have a lawyer at the board meetings. We have diligent notes being taken. We are very clear that, like, what is based on percentage ownership. We have mediation for when we have to come to decisions. I'm imagining four people in a situation where the stakes in many ways could not be higher.
I mean, and it gets...
Is there a lawyer for every polycule?
It gets really complicated too, because it's like, when you want to quit your job, you can talk to your partner and be like, can we do this? Like, I quit a job, and I mean, I didn't talk to him at length about it, but he signed off. I wonder at that point, are we voting? Are we drawing straws? Like, who's making those kind of decisions?
Does everyone have equal equity?
Yeah.
Equal responsibility?
I think it comes down in every relationship to something different, and it's always going to, because people will make exceptions for each other and blah, blah, blah. But I do think there should be some established, like, what you put in, what you take out, or we're all okay with what you put in, certain percentage take out. But similar to like a prenup, I do think that would make a lot of sense. But I think that of anyone who lives together.
Oh,
when roommates live
for
together,
sure.
You need a contract. You need like a list of things.
Oh my God.
Not
for
to be
sure.
Like Nene and Cynthia, but a friendship contract makes a lot
of
sense.
You absolutely do. Like, but especially, I mean, to take it back to the prenup conversation, like the number of people who engage, like, not to quote Little Women, but like marriage is an economic proposition. And the number of people who take who treat long-term relationships and even marriages with really zero seriousness when it comes to what you are meaningfully agreeing to. Like, if you and your husband were to separate today, like, that is a hugely consequential dividing of assets. There are rules around, you know, as it pertains to who earns more, as it pertains to who's put what into the marriage. Like, there are huge considerations, and like, throw in adding prop, like add in owning property to it. Like, it just boggles the mind. And obviously, like, the more people you add to that brew, the more consequential some of those disagreements or misalignments could be.
And they're exponential, right? Because two different people who maybe you're dating somebody and you bring in those two different other people, those people could be fighting, and you and your spouse wouldn't have had a disagreement about this, but those people are having a financial disagreement.
Well, because, I mean, just by the law of math, right? Like, you're not having one relationship. You're having, like, nine individual relationships at any given time across each intersection of it. But even, again, to take it back to two people, which is the majority makeup of couples, queer or straight, like, there, I think, just is never really a level. I mean, it sometimes, but on the whole, there is rarely a level of due diligence given to what it means to truly partner with someone financially. And like, people understand, I think, on like a very generalized level, that money is a huge cause of divorce and a huge stressor in marriages. But I really don't think that, especially as people enter relationships or enter cohabitation, that they take a second to be like, what does that actually mean? Like, how does that manifest? Where are the pain points? How could I avoid them? Because plenty of people can be fun to go out with, great in bed, a good friend, but are they someone you would want to co-own a business with?
You know, and I also think that can be deceptive, right? Because you go into a relationship, someone may be spending money on you and like making you feel taken care of, sending you home in cars, like whatever. And that's a lot of fun at the beginning. But is that person doing really well, or are they just spendy? You don't really know. And I think at some point, resentment can build up, uncomfortable conversations can come up. But I think when you're ready to marry somebody, you're looking at it with rose-colored glasses. And that can be tough if there's more than one person in a relationship, or even in a queer relationship with that's just two people. It can be harder to be, like, completely honest with what you're bothered by. If someone has a bunch of credit card debt, I mean, just to be honest, in certain places, the queer dating pool is a lot smaller. And if you find someone you really, really, really like and they have $200,000 in credit card debt, you might say yes. You might be like, yeah, let's do this. But what are you really agreeing to? Like, that's it's an enormous responsibility. And you add other people into that, it's hard. But I think we're also in a place now where people are able to have those conversations a little more transparently, a little bit more honestly. And I also think we're in a place where, like, people can Google some resources, like a prenup. Like, I wouldn't have maybe gone to the trouble of a prenup because it sounded really complicated when I was younger. But when I was able to just, like, Google it and look at some samples, I was like, oh, we can knock this out in a day. We might as well. And I'm glad we did. Definitely do that. Postnups aren't real. Get a prenup.
Get a prenup. Well, and, you know, not to make this about Love is Blind. Have you watched it?
I have not watched it.
I know you said earlier that you don't watch straight dating shows.
I have a difficult time with cishet-centric dating shows because I find there to be a lot of cruft on the relationship. There's a lot of like expectation and gender stuff. And there is that in queer relationships, 100%. But it's complicated and nuanced. Everyone's a little puzzle box of trauma.
Sorry, tiny digression before the Love is Blind point, which is very relevant to what we're talking about. Did you watch The Queer Ultimatum?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm just going to say one thing about that. I have never in my life, not in my whole 34 years on this planet, seen someone on a reality TV show reunion admit to a domestic violence incident, which resulted in the police being summoned to the, and I think an arrest. Anyway, admitting to that on national television and everyone in the room making it the victim's problem to the point that the victim left the entire reunion in tears and didn't finish it. And I am 100% convinced that the reason it played out that way is because the person who was a domestic abuser is feminine and the person who wasn't is more masculine presenting.
100%. 100,000%. I find in queer relationships, so much stuff is normalized that is abuse. I mean, it's been said a million times. There is no statistical proof, but as a drag queen, I will tell you, gay men are mean. Gay men say mean, hurtful things. I think men bully each other and they get socialized and defense mechanisms. And then, you know, you consume a lot of media, which has a lot of shade and whatever. There's a lot of self-hate that spills into other people. And men can be mean and men can go really low blows. And I have seen men fight in a way that I'm like, if these were two if this was a straight couple, no one would find this acceptable. It would be very Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. But also, like, those men in that situation, even though they can't see it, to them, it's not even a relationship fight. Like, you're so used to seeing men get physical with each other that I think it kind of becomes acceptable. I also think, like, a lot of abuse women can do, either queer or straight women, is less overt. It's not like calling names. Sometimes it's physical, and that was really shocking to see. It is always shocking when someone gets physical. But I think, like, neglect is a hugely not discussed vector for abuse.
Totally.
And people will look at queer relationships and not see those dynamics play out because they look like the script we have for friendships. And we accept a lot more shit from friends than we should from partners.
Well, but then, I mean, to with regards to the how it's perceived masculine versus feminine, like, to take it back to Love is Blind. So we have a really interesting case study with Love is Blind. On two different seasons, there were almost identical situations that were gender swapped. So in season one, there was a couple, they're still married to this day, where the woman disclosed after they had already gotten engaged that she has tens of thousands of dollars of consumer debt on things like makeup, clothes, shopping, whatever, dropped out of school, so has student debt with a degree she did not finish, I believe. And her finances were so kind of catastrophic that the man who, when he entered the show, lived on his own, I believe in a home he owned, ended up having to sell his home and move in with roommates with her so that he could pay off her debts. And it was regarded as, he's chivalrous, he's a gentleman, like, it's, you know, important that when you date someone that you make your and you marry them that you take on their financial burdens as your own, what have you. So that was one case. And then on this season, there was a couple who got engaged. It was similarly disclosed after they had been engaged that the man has like $3,500 worth of debt, has a bad credit score from some defaulted debts, and has a job where he's a 1099 employee. So, and it seems a little MLM-y to me, but either way, like, has a very unstable income. And she left him at the altar. She didn't marry him. And her reason for doing so was
that, you're gonna watch this show.
Right? And there was also, like, all these different disagreements about, like, should a man and a woman be expected to split things 50-50? Like, because she owned a pretty luxurious home, drove luxury cars. Like, would you be able to take on half of my bills? And the framing around taking on someone's financial difficulties as your own in the case of a marriage and that being an important thing for a partner to do, like, the contrast between the two situations was, in my opinion, objectively because of the gender reversal and nothing else.
Yeah, I think you see that on a lot of, like, housewives is interesting because sometimes when the wife is a higher earner, if the man takes a beta role, people are like, that's so empowering. That's so awesome. This is a girl boss, like, whatever. And when the man is loud or boisterous and he is not the high earner, people are like, that's out of line. You're only allowed to take up that kind of space and be animated and bring on the feminine characteristics of socializing if you can prove your masculinity in some way. And I find that to be really uncomfortable too, because I think the men who maybe are really gregarious are offering something full time, like, you know, emotional labor and stuff that other men might not be. And it's weird because those traits are not reversed, right? Like, you see the housewives who are just housewives, just in the sense of career wise, they don't have some external thing. I find that it is either, you either get the idea of, well, it's 50% hers. Like, she has worked for this just the same. You built a life together. You have kids. Or you get this, like, she's a succubus. She's spoiled. And those are the scripts you get. And I don't think most relationships 99% of the time are going to fit into that, especially healthy long-term relationships. But the masculine-feminine coding around money and around responsibilities also spills into just how you conduct yourself. Like, and what kind of business you're in, too. I think a lot of the time, women get a lot of shit for being in certain lines of work that they wouldn't. And they get a lot of negativity around being a high earner if it's in a man's domain. You see women on Housewives who own, like, a med spa chain, and that's not seen as playing in a man's domain. Whereas there are women who own a real estate company or who are investment bankers or CEOs who are on these shows, and it's just completely different.
Well, because to be masculine is empowering, to be feminine is embarrassing. That's it.
Ow.
We will see you next week, next Monday, in fact, back here for an all-new episode of The Financial Confessions. Ciao.